Hello, my name is Martin Kelly. I'm senior editor at Friends Journal, and with me today is David Gross, tuning in from California. And David has been involved with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, and he has written The Definitive Guide to American War Tax Resistance Among Friends, and he can probably hold up the book there, and we can give a plug for that, an almost 600-page book, details everything. In the current issue of Friends Journal, the February issue, he has written a shorter version of that, and it's titled How Quaker War Tax Resistance Came and Went Twice. So thank you for being here with us, David.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a long cross-fertilization between Friends and war tax resistance. But before we go there, why don't you just tell us, what is war tax resistance, and why are Quakers involved in it at all?
War tax resistance simply is the refusal to pay taxes or a certain amount of taxes or certain sorts of taxes because those taxes are used to support war and militarism and the military. And Quakers have been the pretty much largest organizational support for war tax resistance, both theoretically and practically, pretty much throughout the existence of the Society of Friends, although the practice has come and gone, as my article describes.
When you, when I first was sort of getting involved in following you, you have a blog, and you had a series where you would go through an everyday post articles that talked about war tax resistance in Friends Journal year by year. You went year by year through Friends Journal archives and detailed these. And I remember getting a little nervous as you got into more modern history and realizing that you'd be talking about the articles that I was actually working on as well. How did it look like in Friends Journal when you had that 60-year history there to look at?
At the beginning, when Friends Journal was just starting to publish, it was near the end of a period I call the Great Forgetting. It started in the late 19th century, in which war tax resistance in the Society of Friends dwindled to the point where people almost forgot that it had ever been part of the tradition of the society. And then shortly after Friends Journal starts publishing, the practice gets rediscovered. At first, people are influenced by war tax resistors outside of the Society of Friends, and they realize that war tax resistance is congruent with the Quaker peace testimony. And then it starts to develop, and it's only later that Quakers rediscover their own history and realize that it's not a new testimony, but it's really an old testimony that they're rediscovering. And once that happens, there's an explosion of interest in war tax resistance in the Society of Friends. You can see this in the Friends Journal, which starts to devote issues entirely to war tax resistance. And the debate and interest in it just becomes very, very strong. Towards the end of this new Renaissance period, the articles in the Friends Journal are less about, here is an interesting Quaker who resists war taxes, or is war tax resistance a good testimony, and it's much more about, how should Friends resist? What tactics should they use? It becomes taken for granted that Quakers should be war tax resistors. And then around the end of the Cold War, around 1991, there's this crash where mentions of war tax resistance become much, much fewer, and usually when I find them, I'm finding them in the obituary column. The friends who died, and part of what made them known to their fellow friends was that they were war tax resistors, and that was part of the testimony that they had. But you hear much less about people who are doing it in here and now. And now seem to be in a second forgetting period, where the practice is much, much less strong. And where it is practiced, it's practiced by few exemplars. It doesn't have a lot of institutional support anymore.
Yeah, and that jives with my observations. So I should say that I indeed was a war tax resistor myself and involved with the national group. And I was a tax resistor for 20 years and am not anymore, but I'm still very sympathetic. And articles come in. I like to read them, submissions. And there's a few friends who are sort of older friends who every, you know, spring will send me some letters about how we should all be war tax resistors, and sometimes we'll put them in. But that's about all that we're getting. I don't get a lot of things about specifically war tax resistance. Where I see things is articles about someone who is leading a very interesting principled life. They're living low for simplicity purposes, and then it'll sort of come out that they're also vortex resistors or conscious vortex resistors. So it seems to be as much a lifestyle as a sort of political statement now. Is that what you're seeing from that angle, your angle?
It seems to me that there's a great deal of variety, that there are people with resistance, the reason why that makes sense to them. There are other people who are resisting vortexes more as a protest. They think that by taking a stand of civil disobedience, it makes their protest louder, more emphatic. It says that not only do I believe this, but I'm willing to take a stand and do something that's against the law. Takes risks for belief. There are other people still who want to resist war taxes because they hope that will influence the government to create some sort of conscientious objector status for taxpayers. So, for instance, there's a group in the New York yearly meeting that is really focused on trying to get conscientious objection to military taxation legalized. Mm-hmm. So they resist taxes as a way of telling legislatures, look, we feel really strongly about this. We're your constituents. Would you please, help us out, change the law to help us out? So there's different motivations, different reasons why people are doing war tax resistance today.
Right, and what would you say, we had put out a call for reader questions too, and one person said, well, how do you talk to, what do we say to conservatives who might have their own social agendas, abortion being a big one, of course, and choice and such, and they may not want their taxes for that. So mm-hmm. How do Quakers and war tax resistors talk about that whole, the different ways that taxes might be resisted, the different motivations? What makes it different or makes it not so different in your view?
Well, I have an opinion on that, but in the way question has been approached in Quaker history, people have taken both sides on it. Some people have said, well, if you feel really conscientiously, if you have a real strong conscientious objection to funding abortion, to funding this, that, or the other thing, well, for goodness sake, stop paying taxes for it. You really ought to do it. And maybe the government ought to respect that conscientious objection. And there are other people who say, war is just really categorically different from a lot of these other things. If you object to public education or various other parts of the budget, well, that's all well and good. But shedding blood in a tremendously destructive, awful way, and it's just, very, very different from any of those other spending categories, and so it deserves to be treated differently. And there have been Quakers who've been on both sides of that debate.
Sure, and Mike Lee might continue on that. So in your article, though, you go beyond Friends Journal's history and go all the way back to colonial era. How do you see, and you talk about how it's shifted and gone back and forth, how do you see a future shift? How would war tax resistance among Friends have a third flowering? What would that look like? And can you give us a prediction when that will happen and how that will happen?
I can't. The future is very much unknowable. I can have various hopes or dreams of how it might erupt again, but I find current Quaker practices a little bit strange and baffling as somebody who is from outside of the society. Mm-hmm. When I read old texts of how Quakers operated and things they found important and compare that to what happens when I go to a Quaker meeting today, it feels very unfamiliar. For instance, I was invited to attend a Quaker meeting in Northern California and was asked whether I wanted to be part of the meeting and said, well, I'm not really a Christian. I'm not a believer. I don't think I would fit in here. And was told, well, a lot of us aren't either. that wasn't really considered a requirement. And that seemed very foreign to me as somebody who had just spent a lot of time studying 19th century Quakers and 18th century Quakers, for whom biblical justifications and justifications based on direct communication with God on their part were the core of their faith. And something without that seems a little bit strange to me.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure where I was going with this answer.
Well, no, but that's interesting to see someone who is actually gotten very steeped in this particular part of Quaker history and kind of a history of a culture, sees that that sort of current sort of questioning about where our faith is and who our identity is, issues of membership and identity are sort of a constant undertone in sort of Quakers talking all the time in writing and French journal. And we have special issues every year, really, that sort of focus on that. So that's a piece of it, certainly. So we're probably about at our time here, but I'd like to thank you for coming here. And again, the current issue, February, and the article is How Quaker Wartax Resistance Came and Went Twice, and there it is. And you also have the book there, so if folks want to get ever deeper into it. So thank you very much, David, for being on the line here with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, bye-bye.